Listen, I was wondering if you had finished that Woodstock Times in there. If so, would it be... Oh, that's a humdinger of an issue. Just out yesterday. Already read it cover to cover, I did. He scampered back inside and reappeared with the newspaper before finishing his sentence.
That's Brent Robison reading an excerpt from Paul Smart's novel Overlook, a rock and roll fable, on the podcast The Strange Recital. And this is Cat's Cast, the Catskills podcast. If you've been tuned into local media for a while, you might remember Paul Smart, writer for the Woodstock Times and author of the 1994 book Rock and Woodstock. Paul lives in Mexico now, but he's still writing about the Catskills. And The Strange Recital, a podcast about fiction that questions the nature of reality, published Paul's book through their imprint, Recital Publishing. This week, I sat down with Brent Robison and Tom Newton, both of The Strange Recital and Recital Publishing, to talk podcasting, publishing, and writing. Following our interview, stay tuned for a podcast takeover and hear the full Strange Recital episode featuring Paul Smart and Overlook. And here we go to Mount Tremper, New York, where I asked Brent to introduce Tom and Tom to introduce Brent.
Brent Robison lives in the Catskill Mountains of New York with his wife, a maker of fabulous masks, and their wisecracking teenage daughter. His fiction has appeared in over a dozen literary journals and several anthologies, and has won the Literal Latte Short Award, the Chronogram Short Fiction Contest, a fiction fellowship from the New Jersey Council on the Arts, and a Pushcart Prize nomination. His collection of link short stories, The Principle of Ultimate Indivisibility, and his mystery novel, Ponkaka Union, are available from booksellers everywhere.
Tom Newton is the author of War Film, Bloomsbury 2015, Seven Cries of Delight from Recital Publishing 2019, and Voyages to Nowhere from Recital Publishing 2021. He spent many years working in the film industry as a prop man while pursuing a parallel existence as musician, sound engineer, and mastering engineer. He was a participant in London's punk music scene in the late 70s. He lives on a mountain in Woodstock, New York, with his wife and daughter.
Well, you guys have the types of voices that I'd want to listen to on a podcast, so we're off to a good start. What is Strange Recital Podcast? How did it come to be, and how long have you been producing it?
Well, Tom and I met through our writing, our mutual interest in writing, but his audio talents led us in our early conversations to say, why don't we do a podcast about writing or about fiction? And we just happened to sync up quite well in regard to the kind of work we were interested in, both in doing ourselves and in showcasing from other authors, which was stuff that's very hard to categorize, being kind of on the fringes of literary work, not really genre work, but stuff that, like we say, somehow questions the nature of reality.
Originally, we met because I'd written this novella, War Film, and Brent had come across it on the internet and wrote a pretty good review. And I thought, wow, I should contact this guy and thank him. We kind of back and forthed on Facebook a bit, and then we thought, when we realized we lived fairly near each other, so why don't we actually meet in the real world? And then, you know, the idea of the podcast came about. From the very get-go, you know, it was a way of putting our own writing out there. And this was 8 years ago, so podcasts, you know, they were in a different stage then. It was a way of showcasing our own writing, but then we realized that we didn't want it to be just about us. We wanted to be inclusive and try to find, you know, different voices and different styles and authors that we could bring to the public attention.
We just found those mutual interests and plunged in and made a few episodes in advance before we launched, and this was in 2016. So we went for a while with two episodes a month, found that that was a little too much for us, so we cut back to one episode a month, and we're into our eighth year.
And what's the general format of the show, if there's any kind of continuity there that you wanted to talk about?
first we have the story, and then a little interstitial music, and then an author interview. Sometimes they're just, you know, a pretty straight-ahead author interview. And other times, they verge towards a kind of radio play. We like humor, so there's humor involved, but it's not a comedy show. It's almost, the humor's there to make us not come over as important, or, you know what I mean? And we wanted to have it not just a reading, like in an audiobook or something, but a little bit more, but not as far as a radio play. So, hence the sound effects. They just sort of provide a little shift in reality. That was the plan, and that's what we do.
Yeah, so let's talk about the types of writers that you feature on this show. I noticed there are quite a few who are local to the Catskills. So we've got Paul Smart, Allison Galen, Roe Wall, Miriam Silver, Altman, Bob Wyatt, Violet Snow, Sparrow, and then lots of other authors who aren't necessarily Catskills-based, and even some authors from the past, like Edgar Allan Poe or Nathaniel Hawthorne, even Kurt Vonnegut of the recent past. How do you choose who you want to profile? Is it to have anything to do with where we are, or is it more about the work? How does that process work?
Part of it is about where we are. I was publishing a literary journal at the beginning of this century that was focused on showcasing Hudson Valley writers. And I've always had an interest in wanting to give a voice to people who haven't been heard so much. So we didn't necessarily want to chase after famous writers. We like the idea of showcasing people who aren't well known, but we think who are good writers and who have something to say. But it is a constant search for material that is accessible to us, that we don't have to spend too much time and energy asking permission for. I'm constantly on the lookout for stuff like that. We had the Pulitzer Prize winner, Paul Harding, his book, Tinkers. I loved the excerpt I read so much that I found him, reached out to him, and he was perfectly willing to come on. Unfortunately, we had to record him over the phone, but it's a constant search. That's basically all I can say.
Originally, when we connected with each other, Brent, you had told me about an episode that focuses on Paul Smart's new book, which you also published, and we'll get into that in a moment. So Paul Smart is known by many in the Catskills as a local journalist. He lives in Mexico now, and he wrote a book called Overlook. So tell me a little bit about the book, and then also how the podcast made a leap to publishing.
Well, first, let me say that this book has a long history with me. I'm a friend of Paul Smart, and long ago when he was a working journalist in the area, he knew of my literary interests and asked me to read his early draft, and so I gave him a little feedback on that, and then he went away and it disappeared. As far as I knew, nothing would ever come of it. And then he decided to resurrect it again, and he reached out to me. I had thought about it actually over those years because it's something that sort of fits into what we're doing. It's very Catskill-oriented, very atmospheric about the Catskills, featuring an odd loner character, Catskills Mountain Man, but primarily being about, you might say, the ghost of Richard Manuel, the great singer from the band, immediately after his suicide, wildly imagined trip that he makes from the motel in Florida where he died back to Woodstock. And in his journeys, he intersects with this lone mountain man who's a hardcore fan of the band and other music. And so it takes place in an alternate reality, essentially. It's, I think, our 13th book in our catalog. I think that's where we're at now.
After having done the podcast for 3 or 4 years, we were talking. We were sort of limited to time, you know, the time of an episode. So to publish books would be a way to further our interests in a deeper way. We hummed and hawed about it and how much work it would be. And then, you know, we went for it. And I'm glad we did.
So I'd like to play the episode. that you produced of Paul Smart's Overlook. Before we get into it, I mean, it should speak for itself, but are there any kind of notes that you would like to impart about this particular episode, how it was recorded, how you connected with Paul in Mexico, and the process that went behind it?
Well, you know, we connected with Paul via email. We had Brent read the story. Brent read the story. I edited it. I put the sound effects in. And then, you know, we interviewed Paul remotely.
The piece of music on this episode was commissioned by Paul through a friend of his. It's a beautiful piece of cello music.
Stay tuned to hear the full Strange Recital episode featuring Paul Smart and Overlook. But first, a message from our sponsors.
This episode is supported by Hanford Mills Museum. Explore the power of the past and learn about the ingenuity of the historic milling industry. Watch the waterwheel bring a working sawmill to life. Bring a picnic to enjoy by the mill pond. For more information about scheduling a tour or about their 2024 exploration days, visit hanfordmills.org. And by Briars and Brambles Books, the go-to independent book and gift store in the Catskills. Located in Wyndham, New York, right next to the pharmacy, just steps away from the Wyndham Path. Open daily. For more information, visit briarsandbramblesbooks.com or call 518-750-8599.
Spring is in the air, and we've got some vernal episodes in the archives if you'd like to check them out. Like episode 35, Woodstock NY Pollinator Pathway. Episode 37, Vintage Baseball in Delaware County. Episode 86, Black Bears Sharing Space. Episode 65, Six Ticks in the Limelight. And episode 62, Leslie T. Sharp's The Bluebird Chronicles, A Catskills Romance. A quick way to get there? Just type catscast.com, followed by a slash and the episode number. Vintage Baseball, for example, is episode 86, so you can just type catscast.com/86 to get there. And all our shows are keyword searchable, so you can discover, or rediscover, all your favorites at catscast.com. And be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, so you never miss a new one. There's plenty in the hopper. And now, Overlook, from our friends Brent and Tom at the podcast, The Strange Recital. Oh, and a quick note, we've added a few bleeps, like this one, to words we thought might be questionable if younger ears are in the room. Enjoy.
This is The Strange Recital, a podcast about fiction which questions the nature of reality.
Wheels of a Delta 88 spin fast on winter-ravaged upstate roadways. Fallow fields half-encrusted in snow, the rest furrowed in frozen field rot and iced-over mud, unfurl themselves on either side of a moonlit ridge. Spent barns bending under a zillion stars. Homey yellow dash lights and a large speedometer with its needle moving quickly right and left. The lemon moon waning. Clocko heading east into the Catskills terrain he had known since he was a boy riding in the back seat, pretending to be asleep as his dad, all grunts and groans, negated everything his ma said. His younger brother, Gerard, took the place of pa in ma's eyes. He always gave her what she wanted, what she needed, until he left the picture too early, far too early. There was a comfort to this landscape, especially in the dark when it matched his dreams, and not just his guilt at never having measured up. The Oldsmobile purred through sleeping hamlets and villages lit by scattered street lamps dimmed by dead bugs, ringed with winter's dirt crust. Clocko made sure to stick within the speed limit, on the upper side. The stiff-necked, rail-thin, scraggly-bearded driver took in all he passed. Empty storefronts, boarded-up boarding houses with scattered appliances on multiple porches, street lots centered by corrugated metal storage sheds and dark homes, some asbestos or vinyl-sided, some peeling paint and emitting the flickering blue light of unwatched late-night television talk shows, the occasional brightly lit soda pop machine or convenience store, dying fluorescents skittering their way back to black, the sad, endless look of late winter, early spring on the edge of the Catskills. Clocko ejected the big pink tape he'd been playing for days and surrounded himself with strumming guitars and harmonized male voices. The Everly Brothers on lush 8-track. Let It Be Me split into halves, connected by a whir and a click and another whir, accompanied always by this great fan's breath-singing, whistles and hums and an occasional word or two at a half pace behind the song. On the passenger side of the wide blanketed front seat was an apple crate of worn tapes, Grateful Deads and Solo Garcias, Beatles and Beach Boys, Creedence and Elvis and Roy Orbison, even Frank Sinatra, Sicilian folk songs Clocko could only phonetically mouth the words to, strange 10 cents a shot jazz tapes without covers. He cranked the music high and pushed the bass tones, the treble. The whiteness of the road's edge lit swatches of forest cut into by modular homesteading. Old lawn ornaments and picnic tables, battered, frontless mailboxes of all ages and dentedness. An endless rope of sagging, pole-hung telephone and electric wires, echoing the center white and yellow lines, straights, dots, and dashes. Clocko, back in his normal driving mind, flashed back to other journeys at other ages and times. Gerard in the front seat between Ma and Pa on night drives home from his mom's uncle's farm up in Washington County. Clocko stretched out on the back seat under the blanket he now sat on, watching the night sky stay steady above the car, above the entire world they passed through fast and fleetingly. All dead now, except Pa. Clocko passed the time, during those drives or when left at home, with counting, wishing, yearning games that used the cracks in roadways, the alphabet letters in directional signs and advertisements, cows and sheep and front yard chickens, the patterns on peeling wallpaper and the floor's cracked linoleum, alongside his own limited way with numbers. A cracked barn equaled Uncle Artie's farm. 3 sevens and his mother and brother ended up in heaven. He imagined the happiness of blue-lit homes in small towns, watched kids playing on tire swings, walking with bent twig fishing poles down back roads, sliding down long edge-of-town fields on runner sleds or trash can lids. If at home, he'd remember his imaginings from the road. Breathe in, breathe out. The moon rolled up over a distant hill, backlighting road signs and telephone poles and distant trees in a hollow. Clocko turned off the headlights and whooshed on through the ice-edged, equinox-approaching night in the direction of the slow-rolling lemon moon, careening down rural back roads with the force of all memory, hope, and yearning pushing him onward. Should he U-turn back home or sit the night out at Sid's Ford? He could wait for the dawn light to strike his beloved lady's windows, to climb across her far wall and kiss her sweet eyes awake. He could then open his car door as she opened her front door on that porch he knew so well. Could watch, lovingly, as she stepped out onto the road without looking in either direction, to come to his long-closed, now-open arms to say, if only with eyes and spirit and heart, "It's all right. Come to me now, as I've come to you. The time's ours, dear. It's our time." Clocko thought of all those songs that are so good you can't help but stop them halfway through to start them all over again, to hear them better, to not miss any of it with one's meandering mind. Somewhere behind him, a car crested the hill as he drove, lightless. He turned his own beams back on. A cluster of mobile homes appeared to his left, a plywood school bus stop to the right. A faint orange glow emanated from behind a hill. He knew this town, knew that in its center was an all-night gas station, nestled into a corner, where someone would say hi and nod matter-of-factly in his direction. "I want my own memories now," Clocko muttered, while putting a new 8-track in the player. "I want my own story, finally." All around him surged the sound of the band's Music from Big Pink, and his soul's doppelganger, Richard Manuel, singing about his own father, his own tears of rage. "They'll be getting up right around now. Jessie Ketchup's what people call her. She put ketchup on everything back in kindergarten, back in Sunday school, you name it. Some say it was to make up for her dad being gone and all, raised by just her mom. Jessie Ketchup's true as heaven, truer than hell. Pretty girl she is, too, real pretty." Sid Ford's talking a mile a minute as I turn back towards the sun. I slip on my shades. Don't want him to see the yellow in my eyes. An old car starts to pull in as we stand there, Sid talking and me listening. But it quickly U-turned and headed back the way it had come, squishing slugs as it went. The old man shook his head and opened his mouth as if to tell me a whole new story related to the green Oldsmobile and its driver. "What's with all these slugs?" I ask, unable to keep my eyes off the slimy exodus going on as the day warmed to something more than the usual thaw, as if a door to Hades had been ripped open. Some had made it to the highway's double yellow line as if trying to escape the fate of what remained in the road edge's shrinking soot snow patches. "They do that every once in a while. Gets really bad in summer, and occasionally during one of these early thaws. Never seen it quite like this," Sid explains, starting into a long description about why slugs crawl onto asphalt in the first place. "A natural death wish, like porcupines licking the bottoms of cars, getting after the sweetness of transmission fluid, or gnawing on houses painted with toxic paint." Looking at his oil-blackened hands, then up and over his shoulder towards the open bays of his garage, I'm hit with memories of my pa, Ed. I'm a slug. What have I done with my life? I've been a fool, and worse, a dangerous fool. I hate it all. Mickey Twist and Jim Morrison, Bob Dylan and my place in the band, Beatles and Stones, all the music. I hate rock and roll and what it has done to us. I hate this f***ing geezer yapping at me in a high-pitched monotone about goddamn slugs. I've f***ed it all up, but good. I remember the look on Liz's face when she first met Mickey Twist, looking on him the way I'm looking at these slugs. Twist in a jag, all smooth and talking just to her, all misters and ma'ams, beside the Woodstock Village green. Sun just perfect on bright October leaves. And she gripping my hand in hers, her other hand on her pregnant tummy. It was good she didn't see my look, like the one I'd just given the ketchup girl. She'd have slapped me upside the head, then left me. But maybe she did see. We had talked. I told her Mickey was with the record company. A&R. Artists and something or other. "He in sympathy," Twist said with a smile, shaking our hands and scooting away. "Is there a payphone?" I interrupt Sid Ford. "He says no, but if I can keep it local, he'd let me use his." "Woodstock's all," I say. "Got to check on my wife and boy." I walk into the station's crowded office, eyes open for a phone amongst the parts catalogs, calendars, pieces of this and that, and newspapers. When I spot a cord, I follow it under a copy of the Woodstock Times, not yet yellowed like everything else in the room. The phone's old style, heavily rooted to the desk. I try Liz's number. Busy. I try again, just in case I got it wrong the first time. It just rings, unanswered. Same thing happens a third time, and then, on the fourth, it starts going busy again. At least I'm no longer getting people treating me as dead air or some odd, unimportant ghost calling in from the other side. "That's it," she told me, a year or two into the routine that resulted from Twist's presence in town. "I'll restart my career, move back to my parents with the kid, make it in Woodstock on my own if I have to." "Like hell," I said, raising my fist in the doorway. That's my kid. You're my wife. She slammed the door and locked it. How could I have ever explained that I just wanted to hit myself? And so, she left. The first time. A second time, too. Jessie Ketchup comes across the road from her front porch as I'm on the phone. She's leaning against my car, speaking with Sid. She wears capris and a Hello Kitty muscle shirt. The chill air lends her flesh goosebumps. Scream howdy. There's something familiar about her, just as there's been something familiar about everything these past days. Missy here says she has a question for you, Sid says as I approach. You get your wife and kid on the line? I shake my head, looking out at the slick of slug guts, the sun catching it just so. At the mention of wife, the teen girl seductively raises a red, sparkle-toed foot to scratch behind her calf and pouts. I seen you somewhere? The girl asks. You've been parking out here across from my window, mister. Or are you just famous or something? Sid laughs and shakes his head, moving to open his bays. Kids, he mutters. She asks this of every guy who pops through. Jessie Ketchup reminds me a bit of Dawn. It's her attitude, that saucy way she has. A bad girl looking for a bad boy. Didn't you hear me ask you a question, mister? The girl asks louder, pushing her hands back a bit on the car door so her point my direction. You as bad as them slugs. I got a good-looking boy almost your age, I say. You be careful now. Listen, I'm sorry about Jessie, but she being... Sid's saying. I wave a hand and tell him he forgot to ask for money. Oh, I figured you'd just be having a credit card, and I can't take credit cards, he answered. But you being from Woodstock and all, you'll be getting back to me. Do you hear about... Thank you, Sid, I interrupt, before he can launch another diatribe. Listen, I was wondering if you had finished that Woodstock Times in there. If so, would it be... Oh, that's a humdinger of an issue. Just out yesterday. Already read it cover to cover, I did. He scampered back inside and reappeared with the newspaper before finishing his sentence. Sid, you're a good man, I said, as I took the paper from him. I was close to home now. I had a lot of questions that needed real answers.
That was Overlook, written by Paul Smart and narrated by Brent Robison. This is an excerpt from the novel Overlook by Paul Smart, Recital Publishing, 2023.
Hello, Paul, and welcome to The Strange Recital.
Hey, Brent. It's great to hear from you. And Tom, it's a strange way to meet, but at least we're meeting finally.
Yeah, a digital encounter. Better than nothing, right? Now, I know you live in Mexico, so I hope we're not expected to conduct this interview in Spanish.
It would actually be kind of fun to do this in Spanish, but I haven't yet learned how to speak Spanish.
Nor have I. Let's talk about your new novel, Overlook. It has the subtitle, A Rock and Roll Fable. Why is that? Give us a short summary of the book.
Overlook was an attempt to play off of several themes that had caught my attention over the years that I was doing journalism here in the Catskills. On the one hand, there was the whole rock and roll theme involving the tragedy of Richard Manuel's suicide while on a reunion tour down in Florida. And that became mashed together with this other theme that I had been playing with of an itinerant backwoods music fan, shy as can be, who just drives for his own solace. The book follows these two characters, one trying to get home to a Woodstock where he felt whole and where his talents came to fruition, Richard Manuel, and the other being this character, Richie or Clocko, who's just trying to find a place for his own soul to feel safe. The two intersect in various different ways, and there's a lot of scenery in the whole thing and a lot of driving. As for the whole idea of it being a fable, a rock and roll fable, years ago I wrote a nonfiction book about rock and roll in Woodstock, and I covered it quite a bit. And one of the things I learned is that it's a fabulous history.
Yeah.
It's very hard to differentiate the myth from the reality of what was going on. And it's a question whether it really matters, because rock and roll is something that's about fandom as much as anything. Mm-hmm. And it's also something that seems to be fading away at this point. It's becoming part of our past. And so the idea of calling it a rock and roll fable was a way of separating the book from any factual elements that I was using in it. Mm. Rock and roll is a landscape of intuition.
Well, we've heard that the novel was mostly drafted in a small cabin in the Catskill Mountains. Tell us about that.
The way this whole novel came about was that I had gotten a residency at the Platte Clove Cabin, which was this wonderful artist retreat that was run by the Catskill Center for Conservation and Development. It's a one-bedroom cabin that doesn't have any running water. It's a very magical place. And I had a week and I mashed together two projects that I had been mulling in my head for many years. And put them together and wrote the book in a matter of a week. When I got to the end of the whole thing, I stood up and passed out, basically, and came to with nibble marks on my pinky, which I took to be the signs that some small mouse in the place had given me a sign of approval.
Tastes good. Well, this excerpt we just heard is actually made up of two different chapters, chapter 4 near the beginning and chapter 19 more than halfway through. Maybe you wanted to highlight the way you use first person and third person to differentiate the two main characters. Is that right?
The strange thing about the first person and third person elements of this manuscript, with the Richard Manuel being in first person and the Clocko sections being in third person, was that at one point they were reversed, and changing all of that in a deeper draft of the whole thing was like turning around a steamship in a Catskill Creek. It was a daunting process, but it clarified what was going on. I wanted to play with the internal logic and narcissism that is inherent in all rock and roll writing and stardom, etc. And I wanted Clocko to be lost in himself. He could never find who he was. And it's not until the end of the script that he really starts to talk in the form of an I.
There's a lot of driving in this book. Manuel, I keep wanting to say Manuel, but Manuel's driving up from Florida to Woodstock. And Clocko's driving all over the Catskills and even into New Jersey. In my view, that's a uniquely American quality. The cars and highways and back roads are almost like characters.
Not only is driving the standard American meme, it's just embedded in any life one lives in the Catskills or Hudson Valley. I mean, the Hudson Valley, you don't drive quite as much, but when you're deep in the Catskills, you don't have a whole lot of routes to go back and forth on. So you end up retraveling the same ways over and over again. They become embedded in your soul. And then as you get farther away from the deep Catskills, the Woodstocks and Shandakens, Olives, you get into the lands of endless back roads. You also get into these areas where all the towns are variations on each other. East Meredith, Central Meredith, South Courtright, Old Courtright, you know, you name it. So I wanted to capture that sense. And I've also, as a roving peripatetic journalist who in addition to writing for the Woodstock Times, I ran a paper called the Mountain Eagle that covered five different counties, and I would try to hit all five counties each week.
Hmm.
That took me everywhere around the Catskills.
Oh, yes, I know what you mean. Now, I'm going to venture a guess that your story, its mood and settings and people, is connected to Greil Marcus's nonfiction book, The Old Weird America, which digs deep into the music Dylan and the band were making in the basement of Big Pink in 1967. Can you say something about that?
Well, Brent, that's a great supposition, but unfortunately, I haven't read that much Greil Marcus. Years ago, I read some of his stuff, and I really followed him when he was writing for Rolling Stone, and I had the dream, as many young men and women in America did, of becoming a paid rock critic for life. Of course, that's another field like local journalism that kind of has fallen by the wayside.
Yeah.
What I did pull was from just the ethos around rock and roll in the mountains that I had researched heavily when I was working at the Woodstock Times, and that came out in my 1994 book, Rock and Woodstock, which looked into the whole idea of woodshedding pretty deeply, the results of these young, wild men trying to settle down in cabins in the mountains and becoming creative and a little bit older than they actually were in their outlooks. There's a mythic quality to what Robbie Robertson and Richard Manuel and Dylan himself were writing.
Mm.
These are young dudes espousing an age-old wisdom that's not exactly true, but it has proven lasting in many ways. So you take somebody and you throw them into the midst of an old weird America and you're going to get something happening.
Yeah. I know people are still making a pilgrimage to Big Pink after 50 years. I played there myself once. The acoustics were fantastic. I put it down to the unfinished ceiling.
Ha, cool. It's owned by a friend of mine, and I hung out in the basement to hear his band play once, long ago. Nowadays, it's a short-term rental.
You know, the only times I was at Big Pink, besides taking people to see the outside of the place, was years ago when a well-known rock and roll, he was a classical music writer, and he had a mail order, one of the early mail order businesses. And so the whole basement at that point was just filled with albums, most of them classical. And a friend of mine, two fellow writers from the Woodstock Times, this was in the late 80s, early 90s, were living upstairs, and they had a child and was raising the child. And you sort of see a flash of that image of Big Pink in Overlook.
Well, around Woodstock, it's hard not to brush up against someone from the rock world occasionally. During your years as a regional journalist, which I imagine were after Richard Manuel's death, did you meet other members of the band?
I got to know Rick Danko a little bit, and also Garth I got to know a little bit, eating clam strips with him at the old Hojo's down on Route 28 at one point.
Wow.
As for Levon, he became very public during his latter years, and I got to the barn and saw him play a couple times, but for all his public character, I never got to know him that well. I got to know his various managers and the like.
So back to the excerpt. We learn about Klocko's loner personality, his family, his dreams, and that he's a hardcore music fan. And in the second section, we have slugs all over the road and Manuel remembering somebody sinister from his past named Mickey Twist.
I chose the excerpts from here to try to capture the scope of what I'm working with here. Klocko comes out of a character that some friends of mine and I made up in a number of conversations and began to imagine this character of Klocko. He was important to the narrative just for his interior quality of his mind, the way he kept referring back to a few points in his life, the minuscule worldview that gets widened as he goes along, whereas Richard Manuel's worldview is trying to search through his past to find where things went wrong. And it's a wide past that he's dealing with. That's why I chose as a second excerpt this piece where he's at it's actually a gas station, or used to be a gas station on Route 28 out in Shandaken. And the whole idea of the slugs is a mixture of some actual times where we were just completely overrun with slugs deeper up in the Catskills. But there was one season, I think it was in the early 90s, where there was just a massive amount of squirrel deaths on local highways, including the thruway, where everybody you talked to would be talking about how many squirrels were gone. And working this into the book, it made more sense to work with slugs, which are a little less anthropomorphic than a squirrel. And it's a lot cleaner mess than squirrel guts overtaking a chapter in a fable book like Overlook.
Yeah.
So these two lookalikes almost meet each other in this chapter, but the real meeting gets saved for later. No spoilers about what actually happens, but tell us about this idea of doppelgangers in your story. What inspired it?
You know, the whole idea of the doppelgangers was just something that happened as I melded these two completely disparate stories and characters together. I've always been interested in the idea of doppelgangers, having occasionally seen people that seem to mirror each other. And then after I finished this and was starting to edit this into shape for what you're holding in your hands now, for the book that Recital has published, you know, an odd doppelganger thing happened to me, where I started to get reports from friends back in the U.S. They thought they had seen me on Tinker Street or Rock City Road in Woodstock, when at that point I had been in Mexico for a full year. So I'm going to actually see if I can find this guy and have him do my readings for me over the coming months.
Haha, sounds fun. Okay, well, Overlook, a rock and roll fable, is now available in both paperback and Kindle from Amazon, and in paperback from all other booksellers. And it is published by Recital Publishing, I might add. So, Paul, what are you working on now?
I've got a number of projects. The most important right at the moment is that I've started off directing and producing and financing a feature film that I have also written that's based on Don Quixote, but is sort of a documentary of a friend of mine and our friendship over the years. It's called Don Barry, A Quixotic Experiment. And in it, the city I'm living in here, Guanajuato, Mexico, is as large a character as the Don Quixote character. And Sancho Panza has been turned into this beautiful young woman, very talented, who's trying to learn Don Barry's secrets to experimental filmmakers. The other big project I'm working on is a book with Barry Gerson, in which he relates his experiments beyond film, where he's been using color LED lights to cure himself of the maladies of aging. That book, Elixir of Life, is currently with my book designer down here, and we'll be printing it here in Mexico with these amazing printers I work with. One of the themes I'm working on in my film is the idea of disruptive landscape. It comes out of both Werner Herzog and Bruce Chatwin, the idea that there are landscapes that we sometimes run into that completely shift the way we look at the world.
Interesting.
Well, good luck with those projects, and thank you for joining us.
Yes, thanks, Paul.
Thanks, guys, so much. It's been a lot of fun, and I'll definitely come back to Woodstock to see you all and do some readings as soon as I can. Bye.
I'm still thinking about slugs.
I actually quite like slugs. I find them distinguished and odd. This is The Strange Recital on the web at thestrangerecital.com. The music on this episode was Leckhampton Hill by XJ5000 and Cello Improvisation by Michael Severance. This is episode 23101.
And this is CatsCast, the Catskills podcast. Find us at catscast.com. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Instagram at CatsCast. I'm Brett Barry. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
CatsCast is supported by a generous grant from the Nicholas J. Juried Family Foundation and by listeners like you. If you'd like to make a donation, you can do so at catscast.com. Thank you.